I have been asked to say one more time that the church picnic will not be held today, but rather 1 week from today, same time or same time in the day, same station. Everything remains the same, just 1 week later. One of my favorite authors is Joseph Bailey. He has written, I think, one of the finest works on death and dying, now entitled The Last Thing We Talk About. That is a good title. His previous title was one that offended some people. It was called The View from a Hearse. And that's something like what I would have entitled it, I'm afraid. People didn't like to pick it up. Nobody really cared to find out what the view was like. It is the last thing we talk about. And it is the last thing, incidentally, that Moses talks about, at least in the book of Genesis. Bailey lost three sons. And so he writes about death, not only from biblical revelation, but from personal experience. And he has several paragraphs which I think really help us to see the difference of death and the way it is faced today as opposed to the way it was faced a couple of generations ago and in Jacob's day. One of my early memories is of being led into my grandmother's room in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, to give her a final kiss. She was dying, I had been told. So be quiet and behave. That scene impresses me today with its Old Testament quality. Grandma, an imposing person, was conscious, slightly raised on a bolster, her white hair braided and carefully arranged on the quilt she had made as a young woman. The bed, a four-poster, was the one in which she had slept for 50 years, in which her four children had been conceived and born. The wide boarded floor creaked its familiar creak. The kerosene lamp flickered on the massive bureau. A bouquet of sweet peas from Grandma's garden made the room faintly fragrant. The old lady was surrounded by her children and grandchildren. In a few hours, she died. 40 years later, my children were with their grandfather when he had his last heart attack. We gave him oxygen, called the doctor, and then the ambulance came. They then put Grandpa on a stretcher, carried him out of the house. And that was the last his grandchildren saw of him. Children are excluded in most hospitals. In the intensive care unit of the hospital, my wife and I were with him until the visiting hours were over. The mechanics of survival, tubes, needles, oxygen system, electronic pacemaker, were in him and on him and around him. Grandpa died alone at night after visiting hours. His grandsons had no chance to give him a final kiss, to feel the pressure of his hand on their heads. 80%, some people have said, of those who die today die in institutions, not at home. Bailey suggests that wherever possible, people ought to die like Grandma died. And I suspect that is probably true. Unfortunately, it is not always possible. We are not able, many times, to determine the circumstances of our death. We may need to be in a hospital. We may need to have pain cared for with strong medication. We may not even die in the hospital at all. We may die in some sudden way. Therefore, we may not be able to choose the circumstances of our death. But our attitude toward death is something that we can change. And it is significant to me that it is not until Jacob's attitude toward death changed that God let him die. As I said to you before, Jacob had been dying for years. It seems to me that it started many years before when Rachel died. There was the woman that had won his heart, his affections, his romantic feelings. She had caught his imagination. And when Rachel died on the way to Bethlehem, much of Jacob died too. And we know from the things that he said subsequent to that loss that it was a tremendous tragedy in his life. He does not speak of his death there, but it seems to me that part of him did die, and that that is the backdrop for much of his desire to die as years went by. Then he was told sometime later that the son whom Rachel had presented to him, the son of his preference, of the wife of his preference, had been killed far away from home. The body had not even been recovered. It was at that time that Jacob began to talk about death openly. He obviously desired it. He desired it because he saw death as the end of everything. And frankly, he was ready for that. But God wasn't. So years went on, a number of years. And then another son of Jacob is in jeopardy. Simeon has been taken hostage. And the right-hand man of Pharaoh has insisted that if Jacob's sons are telling the truth, they will produce the only other son of Rachel as evidence. And now two more sons are in jeopardy. And Jacob again begins to talk about death with, I think, a desire to die, that it might end all things. But God is not ready for Jacob to die. It is years later that Jacob discovers, to his shock and to his delight, that the son of his only loved wife, Rachel, is not dead, but alive. That he is in a position of power and prominence in Egypt, and that he has asked that his father and his family come to live with him. Jacob, you remember, when he met his son after all those years, more years away from him than with him, wept, and he said, "Now I am ready to die." But God still wasn't ready for Jacob to die. Jacob saw that life could end now because all that was important to him had happened. He was ready to pull the plug. God was not. Another 17 years must pass. And it is only in Genesis chapter 50, at the very dying breath of Jacob, that Jacob is ready to die, because now Jacob understands death in a totally different light. And it is that understanding that God wants all of us to have. We may not be able to determine the circumstances of our death, but God does give us a choice about our attitude toward death. And it is one of the most significant things we can establish. Because to me, death is the ultimate test. You see, you can fail like Jacob failed. And so long as God lets you can live it down. But if you fail at death, there are no second chances. It is the great test of a man's faith. Now, look with me at how Jacob's attitude toward death has changed. He has blessed his sons. We see it actually beginning in Genesis chapter 47. He has summoned his son Joseph. He has come, I think, for a private interview, and it is at the end of chapter 47 that Joseph is made to solemnly swear to his father that he will see to it that Jacob is buried in the cave of Machpelah in Canaan, not Egypt. Then the sons are brought in, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob, crossing his hands, blesses the younger and exalts him over the older. He gives Joseph a double portion. Part of the right of the firstborn, the right of a double portion of inheritance. And after he has finished with Joseph and his sons, all of the sons are brought around the bedside. Jacob has summoned all of his strength. He has put his feet down on the floor. He has sat on the edge of the bed so that he may look at his sons eyeball to eyeball, and he pronounces upon them the blessings that are appropriate to them. Having done that,
Jacob now uses what I consider to be his last breath, his final words, and that is the words that he speaks concerning the arrangements for his burial. And that is in verses 29 through 33 of chapter 49. Notice how meticulous Jacob is in these instructions. He is meticulous about the matter. He charged them, he commanded them, and he tells them in very precise terms, not just that he is to be buried in Canaan, but that he is to be buried in the family sepulcher. That piece of ground and the cave which was in that field that had belonged to Machpelah, now it belongs to Abraham. He goes through a very meticulous description of the property. You need to understand that those sons had not been at that property for years. They may have had to ask directions. But another reason is that property ownership was verbally communicated. The contract was verbal, not in writing. And therefore, the transaction which was verbally made by Abraham had to be verbally passed on by Jacob to his sons. That is why the precise detail is given about the location of the field and the sepulcher and so on. We know from verse 5 of chapter 50 that the last time that Jacob had been there, at least I assume it was his last time, he was there to bury his wife Leah. He would have buried Rachel there, I believe, if he could have, but circumstances prevented it. He has buried Leah there, and at the time of the burial of Leah, he has dug out, verse 5 tells us, he has hewn out of the rock another place where he himself will be laid, his body. And it is that place that he tells his son that they must bring him to in order to bury him in the land of Canaan. He has given his sons the charge. He is assured of the fact not only that these sons will carry it out, but he has already gotten Joseph to make a solemn vow that this will take place. Having been assured of his proper burial, speaking with his last breath, he drew his feet into the bed and expired. I get the distinct impression that he died rather quickly after having pronounced these words. I get the impression, and knowing Jacob, it is not hard to believe, that Jacob wasn't planning on dying until he said what had to be said. And it's almost like our Lord, probably that's a little extreme, but where our Lord yielded up his spirit. I have this feeling that Jacob was going to die when he was ready. And he was ready when he had said what needed to be said. He breathed his last. I do not think that weeks went by. I suspect he drew himself into the bed, and there before his sons, to whom he had been speaking, he died before their very eyes. That brings about the response to his death in chapter 50. I want you to notice that verses 1 through 3 are the response of Joseph and of the Egyptians, but not of his brothers. Do you notice that? Look what it says. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And then he commands the servants to embalm him. And then verse 3, now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Joseph and the Egyptians, but no brothers. Why? Because their response is so significant, Moses has to make a separate paragraph of it starting at verse 15. And their response is significantly different than Joseph's, which I think has some lessons for us. Joseph undoubtedly was the one who was closest to his father. It is no surprise that he should be cited and picked out as the one to express the mourning, perhaps, that was typical of others, too. He fell on his father's face. He wept over him and he kissed him. He and his father had a special relationship that had begun because he was the firstborn of Rachel. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians. I understand that this would be like the President of the United States. He has his own surgeon. He has his own doctor. There is a medical staff that attends to his needs. Joseph was second in all of the land of Egypt, and apparently there were those whose function it was to look after the medical needs of Joseph and, I suppose, of his family as well. And so Joseph summoned these men. I do not understand these are physicians who are well qualified to embalm. I do not think, however, that they were the morticians of the land. I say that because the morticians would have been more involved in the incantations and all of the magic and so on of pagan Egyptian death practices, which I do not think that Joseph cared to have his father be a part of. So as I understand it, he calls in Quincy to do the job. He is embalmed professionally by these physicians, but without all of the rituals and routines that may have been a part of Egypt's culture and of their religious practice. Now, it was necessary for him to be embalmed. I do not think that this is saying that it is necessary for every Christian to be embalmed. Do not misunderstand me. But it was necessary in the case of Joseph's father. In fact, I think it tells us the reason why Rachel was buried on the way to Bethlehem. It was too far, too long, and too hot to take a body from where she was to where she should have been. And therefore, they buried her beside the way. It was one of the things that had to be done in travel. We know that that is the case. When men are at sea and someone dies, it, at least in olden days, was necessary to bury them at sea. There was no means to do otherwise. Remember that they said of Lazarus after 3 days in the grave, "Behold, he stinketh." It was a practical reality. Decomposition began. Now, you can imagine if Lazarus smelled after 3 days, how would you like to be stuck with Jacob on the way from Egypt up to Canaan? It would be a problem, apart from embalming. So embalming was a practical necessity so that that body could be transported a significant distance and over a long period of time without the offense that might have been the natural consequence of death. So the embalming is done. Notice it says that there are 40 days required for it. Herodotus and others have described the Egyptian embalming process. I think since lunch is coming upon us, I will forego that. And you look at the footnote in the printed message for all of the lovely details about the Egyptian process of embalming. It was done. 40 days had taken place. The mourning period was actually extended 70 days or 30 days beyond that. And that is before they begin to move the body. Interestingly, we are told that the period of mourning for a pharaoh was 72 days. That tells us that Joseph and his father Jacob were highly regarded to get a 70-day mourning period. Now, the necessity was for Joseph that he had to secure permission to leave the land with his father. It is possible that Pharaoh may have been offended that Egyptian soil was not good enough for the body and the bones of Joseph's father. And so Joseph must petition for the privilege of leaving the land and burying his father in the land of Canaan. He does this in a little bit of an unusual way, so far as we can suppose, for Joseph does not go directly to Pharaoh and ask permission. He goes indirectly through Pharaoh's servants, it says. Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, verse 4. And it is possible, then, that the reason for this indirect approach is that Joseph may have had some kind of ceremonial defilement which was not exactly attractive to the Pharaoh, and therefore his personal appearance may have been an offense to his master. We do not know, but there is the indirect request, and he presents it as the fulfilling of a solemn vow, which of course it was. It was an obligation. It wasn't therefore Joseph's preference. It was Jacob's command, and he had made a solemn oath to do what his father had asked. So he says, "Behold, I am," his father had said when he was dying, "Behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me." So Joseph says, "Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return." And so Pharaoh grants his petition in the next verse, and now the funeral procession may begin. It, in my estimation, is one of the grandest and one of the largest funeral processions in all of history. It must have been spectacular. It would make anything that we have seen in our days look pale. Notice the description of it in verses 7 through 9. Joseph went up to bury his father, And with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. This was a state occasion. Now, of course, you would understand from our own contemporary society. When a ruler of state, when a head of state dies, then it is expected that the dignitaries of other nations will attend that as a mark of their respect and so on for the one who has passed on. That was surely the case here. You have, in effect, the cabinet and all of the great officials of the kingdom of Egypt. And you will remember that as second in command, all of these people, I would assume, were subservient, were subordinate to Joseph. They have come as a mark of respect primarily for Joseph and secondarily for his father. It is a great group of governmental officers. It may have included those down the line, even those who perhaps were servants in the household as well. In addition to that group, a tremendously large group from what we are told in verse 9, a very great company. In addition to this group, there is Joseph and all of his brothers and the adult members of the household. And we know that by this time there must have been at least a greater number than those who had come down to the land of Egypt some 17 years before. So there is this company of the adults. The children are left behind. The cattle are left as well in Goshen. But all of the family make their trek back to the land of promise. And if that is not enough, there is yet another group that is attached. This is the group that was the logistics group, as I understand it. They were not those who necessarily were the personal friends or even the subordinates of Joseph, but they were the logistics crew. You had to get the body up there. That meant transportation. You had to get the elderly or the feeble there as well. And you remember in bringing them down to Egypt, Pharaoh had sent chariots and carts and whatever to bring them down. So you've got this whole logistics problem of transporting these people as easily as possible up to the land of Canaan. And because you have all of these state officials, you have the problem of security. And so attached as well are these horsemen and charioteers who provide the security for the entire troop. I have to persist in saying it was a rather impressive sight. And the Canaanites agree with me. Notice their response to it. Verse 10, when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, and they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Something very interesting about this. Normally we would have expected that the trek from Egypt up into the land of Canaan would have been, if you would look at your map in the back of your Bible, you would see that they would go slightly to the east, following the curvature of the Mediterranean Sea, and they would stay as far as they could to the west, and they would go north, slightly east, and then they would go into the land of Canaan, they would go through the land of the Philistines, and remember, this was the portion of land that had been controlled largely by those who now dominated politically the scene in Egypt. It would seemingly have been the safest route. They would have gone up and then approached the land of Egypt, or the land of Canaan, from the west. They did not do that, however. The text seems to indicate that they went up instead, went around to the east of the Dead Sea, and approached from east of the Jordan, crossed then, going westward. That would seem to be somewhat out of the way. I do not know why they did it. There may have been political reasons, security reasons. Obviously, we don't know why. Isn't it interesting, however, that that approach more closely approximated the route which would be taken by Israel as they fulfilled the hopes and the promises that had been made to the nation Israel? Well, they come in, they cross over the Jordan, now going westward, and as they cross the Jordan and enter into the land of Canaan, they stop at what I assume to be the first logistically appropriate place, and they pitch camp. And as I understand it, and the details are a little sketchy, I am not sure that it's that significant then, but it appears that what happens is that they stop at this threshing floor where we have no idea where it is or any of the particulars, but it was the place that was known among the Canaanites. They stopped at this threshing floor, and they observed the seven-day period of mourning. I take it that that is a great collective mourning experience, and it is done, I think, primarily for the benefit of the Egyptians. The Egyptians then, as I see it, stay there after the 7 days, and now the Hebrew people go with the body of Jacob their father, and they go on into the land of Canaan, take the body, place it in the cave of Machpelah, have their own private mourning session, which is not described, which the Canaanites did not observe, and I think neither did the Egyptians. They return then, come back to the threshing floor, are rejoined to the Egyptian forces, and all make their trek back down to Egypt. That is the way I understand the event taking place. It was a great lamentation. The Canaanites were duly impressed. Verses 12 through 14 seem to me to be a description of the fact that Israel, the sons of Israel, did precisely as their father had commanded them and carried out the command to the most meticulous detail. Therefore, they returned. Now, verses 15 and following are a description, through verse 21, are a description of the response of Joseph's brothers. We've already seen Joseph's response, and we have observed that of the Egyptians. Tremendous respect and all of that. Joseph's brothers don't respond with the grief we would expect, but rather with guilt and fear. That is the whole essence. You see, while Joseph could look at his father and he could see that he was now separated from one whom he had loved and he could grieve on that level, Joseph's other brothers, especially not Benjamin, I would suppose, Joseph's other brothers looked at this death in an entirely different way. And basically, they looked at it as the end again. The end of them, largely. They saw that as the last straw. They saw themselves in tremendous jeopardy, and therefore they saw Jacob's passing on as tremendous tragedy for them. Now, you have to understand why that would be so. This is what I like to call the chickens coming home to roost. It always happens this way. The Scripture says, to those who are evil, all things are evil. Let me tell you how the evil mind works. You can never think this way, so I've got to spell it out for you. Here you are, years before, a brother of Joseph. You have observed very clearly Jacob's preference for Rachel. And you have observed, to your consternation, Jacob's preference for Rachel's firstborn son, Joseph. You have noticed that whatever Joseph does is right. And whatever you do, it seems, is wrong. You grow up to hate that kid with a passion. And then when this kid comes along and starts telling you about dreams where all of the rest of you bow down to him, that is the last straw. The brothers, therefore, had a number of powwows, not just the one they had out in the field. They had a number of sessions, and they said, just you wait, Joseph. We're going to get you. And we're going to kill you, and then nobody's going to bow down to you. There was only one problem, only one hitch. Jacob. They knew that if they bumped off Joseph, they had to face Jacob. And there was only one thing worse than facing Joseph. And that was facing Jacob minus Joseph. So what did they say? They said, someday, somehow, we are going to separate Jacob and Joseph. And once Jacob is out of the picture, so is Joseph. And that's precisely what happened historically. Jacob sent Joseph on a little expedition to see how his brothers were doing. And in the process of doing so, he got much farther away from home than his father intended. And his father now no longer could overlook the situation and protect his son. And knowing that, his brothers said this, "It's finally happened. At last, we have Joseph minus Jacob. And now all of Joseph's protection is gone." And they got rid of him. Now do you see how the chickens come home to roost? Here they are. They have been brought down to Egypt. And they have heard Joseph say that he has forgiven them, that he is going to provide for them. They've heard it. They haven't really believed it, even though they've lived in it for 17 years. Now, Daddy is gone. And the old minds of Joseph's brothers are starting to turn again. And they're saying, "Hey guys, do you remember what we said? We said Joseph was only as safe as long as Jacob was around. Now the tables have been turned. And it is not Joseph who is in jeopardy. It's us. And Jacob is gone. We've had it. We're cooked." That was the fear. No wonder the very thing they had looked forward to was now the thing they most dreaded. I can imagine those brothers must have prayed for the health of Jacob. Jacob wanted to die, but his sons didn't want him to die. Because once Jacob was gone, Joseph could do what he wanted. They just didn't understand that what Joseph wanted to do was to be gracious to his brothers. That was the fear. Now, I know that we are not told everything that transpired between Jacob and his sons. But I got to tell you, this little plot that the brothers of Joseph came up with, to me, smells. When they send word, they say, "Joseph," and by the way, I don't know whether they sent word by Benjamin, some neutral party. They send this message to Joseph. They don't want to come quite yet because they think it may be over. So they send a message and they say, "You know, Daddy actually had one more charge. He didn't tell you, he told us to tell you, and so we're going to pass it on. The charge was, please forgive my sons for what they've done to you." They hoped that they could play on the sympathies of Joseph for his father, and that maybe the sympathy he had for his father would still carry on even though Jacob was gone. I got to tell you, I don't think Jacob ever said it. And if Jacob had it to say, he would have said it in private to Joseph when he had him there alone in the tent. All I see is deception. I see fear. I do not see faith. And you see, therefore, the brothers of Joseph had the same mentality toward death that Jacob had once had. When death comes, it's all over. It's the end. They saw it as the end for them. They saw it as the end of Jacob's control, of Jacob's influence, of Jacob's protection. They understood all of the blessings that they had experienced at the hand of Joseph as somehow coming through Jacob. And they were wrong. They saw death as the end. Well, Joseph's response is a classic, and it is a model, is it not, for all of us. He says two things. Notice, by the way, Joseph wept. That was a real incentive. It was a real encouragement. And now they came and fell down. The very thing they had dreaded most in life from the dreams of Joseph as a boy was to fall down in submission to Joseph. And now they voluntarily, in fear, fall down before him and say, "We are yours. We're your servants." Well, they really were, but at least they admitted it. "Behold, we are your servants." Verse 18. Notice Joseph's response. "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." It is not Joseph's obligation to bring discipline and to punish his brothers for their sins. Joseph does not know the measure or the degree of guilt. He does not know the motives of each. Correction and punishment are God's in the sense of getting even, of vengeance. Now, justice is another issue. There is the matter of discipline in the church. There is a matter of righteousness. But here we are talking about personal offenses. It is not our responsibility. It is not our right. It is not even our privilege to bring about vengeance. That is God's.
and therefore Joseph will have none of it. And he can go on and say, as he has said before, as for you, you meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. The same story as he had said to them 17 years before. I can allow what has happened to happen because God is sovereign. God is in control. God can have the right things happen for the wrong reasons. He can use sin to promote His purposes and His plan. And therefore, He does not have to retaliate. What has happened is the will of God for His life. Therefore, He may rejoice. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. They saw death in an entirely different light. They saw it as the end not only of an era, but an end for them. Now I want you to notice, and I had to be impressed with the fact that death is the central theme. Between verse 21 and verse 22, there is over 50 years of history that is passed, that is brushed aside. It is not that there is nothing here for us to learn, but rather it does not fit the purpose which Moses is bringing us to at the end of this book. Moses is concerned with us focusing our attention on death and dying. Therefore, he has brought two funerals, two deaths into one chapter. And that is repetition to say it is important how we view death and dying. Joseph now has come to the point in his life where he knows death is around the corner. And so he lived 110 years, less than his forefathers, but a ripe old age. He had been privileged to see the third generation, that is, his great-great-grandchildren, and as grandfathers always do, to have them on your knee and to show them love and affection. It is not, as I understand it, an adoptive right that is here described, but simply a grandfatherly prerogative to show love to the offspring of our descendants. He has had that privilege, and he summons now, notice, he summons his brothers. I find that interesting. That is not the word I was looking for. I expected him to summon his sons. But notice his brothers outlive him. He calls his brothers and now instructs his brothers as to how they are to bury him. I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Isn't it interesting to notice the difference between the way Jacob was buried and Joseph was buried? Really, the intent of both was the same. They both were buried in faith. Jacob was buried in faith. He went back to the land of Canaan, and that was to say to his descendants, that is where home is. That is where the blessings will be realized and fulfilled. That is where my ancestors' remains have been left. That is where you must go. That's home. But the other side of it was that there were going to be a number of years yet to come when Israel wouldn't be in Canaan. And Joseph chose that his death would be a reminder to his brothers and to their descendants that they had a journey ahead. And Joseph wants his death to be a reminder too. Can you imagine the children who would be playing in the house? And mother would say, look out, Jeremiah, don't knock over that coffin. What's in it? Well, that's Joseph. Joseph's in there. They're right there in that box. The kids, they must have walked around it, they'd look at that thing, they'd wonder what was going on, and they'd say, why is it here? They bury these things. Not this one. This one is going to go to Canaan. And it's waiting. It's waiting for the time when God takes Israel back. And Joseph said, he's going with them. So his bones wait till that day. Both of them were a testimony to the faith of those men, but in a different way. I want you to notice how these men deal with death. They see death not as the end. You know, if Moses were a writer today, Moses wouldn't sell many books.
Because most people aren't going to buy a book where there's two funerals at the end. That's not the way. It's not they lived happily ever after. People say, you know, what an icky way to end the book. Couldn't you have had some bright note? Two coffins? What we need to understand is Genesis chapter 50 is the end of this book. But Moses had four more books to write. And God had 61 of them after that. This is the end of an era, but it is not the end of God's program. And death is only a momentary delay. It is not the termination of that. Many people have looked at the Old Testament and they say, you know, the Old Testament, they really didn't have a very clear idea of what happened after death. Phooey. Look at what he says. I noticed this expression that is used twice in the passage we've been studying, where it talks about being gathered to his people. Jacob said it of himself. Moses said it of Jacob when he died. It was also said of Isaac. It was also said of Abraham. I remember one time in seminary, we, as you know, we have a son who passed away, and he was 3.5 months old, and the question was, what happens to children when they die? And one of the texts that was mentioned is in 2 Samuel chapter 12, where David's son died. And David says, he shall not return to me, but I shall go to be with him. You know what some people say that means? That means, oh, goody, my consolation is that when I die, I get to lay on the piece of ground next to his. Terrific! What consolation! My bones can rot by his bones. That is foolishness. What they are saying is that the saints of old understood to die was to rejoin loved ones in the Lord. That's why he says, bury me there. Because their bones are there? No, because the fulfillment of that is going to come to pass. God says, remember he quotes in Matthew, he says when he's speaking of resurrection, that God said, I am the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. Not I was. Abraham, when he sacrificed his son, he sacrificed him, the book of Hebrews says, with a resurrection faith. Abraham said, if that man's life is taken, God will raise him up. So to die, in part, was to be rejoined to those that we love, who trust in God, who has been separated from us by death. And death now joins us to them, not just in the ground, but in some kind of unity. We know from the New Testament more clearly about that. And so we shall ever be together with the Lord. That is the hope of the Old Testament. And you know what it enables a man to do? It enables a man to look death squarely in the eye. It is amazing to me. Jacob says, I'm going to die. Joseph says, I'm going to die. And like Joel Bailey says, nobody says I'm going to die today. You don't die, you pass on. You're not buried, you're interred. And you don't go to a cemetery, you go to a memorial park. Nobody dies. Nobody wants to talk about death. Why? Because they have not looked death in the eye. If you see death as the end, you don't want to talk about it. Or you do the opposite. At the wrong point in your spiritual life, you desire death when you shouldn't, because you think death will end your problems. That isn't right either. Jacob wanted to die. Jonah wanted to die. Elijah wanted to die. Because they misunderstood death. One time I had the opportunity to deal with a young man who had tried to commit suicide. He had his stomach full of rat poison, and we were on the way to the hospital. I didn't know whether it was working or not, so I said to him rather hastily on the way, what do you think will happen after death? He said, well, I believe in reincarnation. I believe that if I die now, I get another shot at it, and maybe it'll be better. And I said to him, you know, if reincarnation's right, I understand why suicide's a tempting option. But if the Bible is right, suicide's a very dangerous course of action. Because my Bible says in Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed unto men once to die. Not 10 times, 12 times, 14 times. And after that, the judgment, not reincarnation, but standing before God and giving account of all of those things which cannot be reversed. I see men who, when they have come to grips with death and they see death is not the end, it is only a momentary delay, it is only a pause, it is only a comma, not a period, that they can face death squarely. They can speak of it. My first funeral, it started in visiting a woman in the hospital. I went to see her and we talked. Nobody ever told me she was dying. I was too dumb to ask. I just assumed it. When we talked of death and what happened after death. Eventually, when I did the funeral, I was shocked when, as we stood around the graveside, the husband went around saying to all the people, "She never knew. She never knew." I said to myself, "She didn't? She shouldn't? She wouldn't? I knew. We talked about it." But the last moments of their life, the last hours and days, were all spent in deception. Because death to him was the end. And of all things, you would not want people to think the end was near. And so you avoided it. Tragic. What happens? Two temptations. One of them is the suicidal temptation. If death is the end of it all, then let's have it. But it isn't the end. It's the beginning. And the other is, for the unbeliever, if death is the end, then I must eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow I might die. But let's not talk about death. That's the whole mentality. Death is not the end. Old Testament faith was faith in resurrection. It was faith in life after death. And that is why Moses chose death to be the central theme of his last chapter of his first book. And in the last chapter of the last book, death will be abolished, as Revelation says. We will return to paradise and to the tree of life, where there is no death, there is no sorrow, there is no tears. Death in Genesis is the result of sin. The wages of sin is death. It is a reality. But the man of faith faces death knowing it is not the end. It is only the beginning. We must stop. Let's close in prayer.